Okay, so last time we talked about starting at the beginning, load store reordering. That we had this notion when we are thinking about, you know, how we might implement things with atomic operations, that, well, loads and stores are generally atomic, they happen all at once, so that means we're fine, but it turned out not, because they can be reordered both by the compiler and the processor. And the reason for this is that basically the compiler and the processor, by default, basically don't worry about other cores or threads, so they say, okay, we can just do whatever we need to do, assuming that no other threads are using these values, so that means that if we're writing to the value, we don't need to do it right away. Even though if there is another core thread using that value, that can be a big problem. And the big solution for this is that when someone's writing synchronization constructs, like the ones you'd use from, say, pthreads, they're going to add directives and special instructions to prevent reordering from happening when it would be bad. So in particular, things like locks and pthread join are going to be written to stop reordering. So for example, for locks, they'll make sure that before you acquire the lock and after you release the lock, that everything that was protected by that lock is finished. It doesn't get reordered across that lock or unlock operation. We also mentioned dealing with libraries. So when we're dealing with a library which has some sort of data structure, we often want to access different parts of that data structure from multiple threads, and we need to know, is that okay? And that depends on the internals of the library. So generally, we rely on them telling us. And for the case of the C++ standard library, they've documented, okay, here's how, say, for example, vector and map and things like that work. They've said, you can read anything that is not being written by another thread, even if it's only a part of the vector. But if the vector or the map is being resized, then you might be in trouble, is the sort of default rule. And by having that rule, what's happening is that the person who's implementing the vector or map is guaranteeing that they're not going to do something under the covers, like, you know, having a cache that gets reallocated when you read from things in order to make that true. Looked at, well, you know, if we can access values from multiple cores, how does that actually work? And we learned that we needed to support caching, that our processors were efficient because they cached values. And this means that somehow we need to agree that if one processor has a value cached and another processor has the same value cached, but what happens if both of them want to modify the value? And we learned that the way that processors deal with this is that they take churns, is that they have some mechanism of ensuring that if a value is being modified, only one core has it at a time in its cache. But this means that if two cores are trying to modify something that's in the same block of the cache, then they'll have to take churns accessing that, and that'll be slower than if they, you know, were trying to modify two separate values that are in separate cache blocks. And where this becomes noticeable to us as application developers is that even if there's no race condition, even if we are we have a cache block and we're accessing two different parts, there's no actual interference, because they're in the same cache block, we'll experience this taking churns effect and our performance can be much slower. And this phenomenon is known as false sharing. False because, well, the values aren't really shared. But we get sort of the performance effects as if they were. So then we looked at, okay, so, you know, given how values are shared, we wanted to talk about implementing locks. So we mentioned that, well, if we implement locks, we're going to need some special processor support. And we talked about spin locks before, but we want to extend that to have waiting locks, that we don't want to just busy wait for something. So we looked at sort of implementing real locks where we start with these spin locks, which would be weight using the CPU, and we'd extend that to have this lock that protects a list of waiting threads, and this Boolean is the mutex lock. And basically, our spin lock, you know, would be acquired just to manipulate the list of waiting threads. So when we locked, we'd add ourselves to the list if we had to, otherwise we'd do nothing. When we unlocked, we remove a thread from the list if we had to, otherwise we'd do nothing. And to make this work, we needed something beyond just hardware support. We needed operating system support, that this lock had to be integrated with the scheduler. But this is the kind of most common locks we'll use, because usually we want it to be the case that if we're waiting for a lock, that we end up having that wait let other things run on the system. Okay. Then we talked about monitors. So monitors are going to be a way of exposing a wait for something to become true operation. So locks like this, they don't let us wait for something else to become true. And we actually saw that, well, we can do that with like pthread join, but we want something more general than that, where we can wait for other things to happen. And monitors are a general way of doing that, where we're going to add to our locks this abstraction called a condition variable, which is really badly named. A condition variable is a list of waiting threads. Why is it called a condition variable? Some historical reasons, not a good name. And the list of waiting threads has three important operations. So one is this wait operation. That's to the thread can call this to add itself to the list. And this also takes a lock. The idea is that we've acquired some mutex. So this is a mutex lock. Some mutex that protects the shared state. We want to make sure that we have a consistent view of this shared state. We've checked something about that shared state and found out it's not true. And we decided, okay, we're going to start waiting. So this will start waiting and unlock the lock while we're waiting. Why do we want to unlock the lock? Because, well, we want this stuff to change. And it's not going to change while we have the lock, which is unfortunate for checking something about it, but not fortunate for waiting. And then we have this broadcast or signal operation, which remove either all the threads or one of the threads from that waiting list and let them start running again. And well, when they start running again, well, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to reacquire the lock they previously had. So we're going to look more at how we use monitors today. First, I'll take questions. I have a few questions already. So one question, do spin locks or waiting locks need to be acquired for reads? So for reads, generally speaking, if we have two threads reading a value, we'll get consistent values for that read, regardless of the whether we synchronize them. So as long as we're not concerned about a write happening in between those reads, there shouldn't be a problem. But if we are concerned about another thread writing while we might be reading, then we're going to have to use some sort of locking. So you might say, wait a moment, if you're just telling me that we have to lock for all reads, that's going to mean that we can only do one read at a time. Can't we do better than that? And the answer is yes, and we'll talk about that probably on Thursday. So then a question on the quiz. On quiz three, why does do while not lurk? So let's look at that quiz. Draw this over here. So on the quiz, question three. So question three here is, question is, why does do while not work? So if we look at this condition here, we have a check where we want to wait for both to be finished. And the problem here is that first finish and finish first and finish second could have been called at any time relative to wait for finished. Even if they're all called at the same time, maybe we got unlucky and the scheduler, you know, his context switched away just before we acquired this lock and let both first finished and finished second run. And in that case, we want to not call wait at all. Because if we call wait, then we're going to wait for someone to broadcast, but they already have done that. So that's why we need to use a while and not a do while. Does that answer that question? And then question, why don't we pass a lock to broadcast and signal? So the wait operation, it's going to have to, you know, going to have to remember this lock somehow. And because the wait operation remembers this lock somehow, we don't need to pass that information to broadcast or signal. That's going to be done, remembered by the wait. And a question, does false sharing occur with local variables in the stack, or is it only for heap memory, or do all variables go to the cache? So everything is going to be stored in the cache, but our cache blocks are these chunks of memory which have contiguous addresses. So if we have two threads, they're going to have, you know, thread one stack, thread two stack, and these are going to be pretty far apart, like at least a few kilobytes apart. So they're not going to be ever share the same cache block, so we won't have false sharing there. So where we'd be concerned about false sharing are generally shared data structures like a shared array, which could be on the heap or the stack, where they are going to have close by addresses. Then on the another question on the quiz, why does the check the lock taken flag if it's false call the normal lock mutex function, otherwise return an error? So there's one way that this is a problem is that if we check the lock taken flag without the spin lock, then we have issues with that read being reordered. We need something to prevent that read from being reordered. If we check it with the spin lock, then we're trying to acquire the spin lock twice. Or we're releasing the spin lock in between when we check the flag and when we call lock mutex, in which case there's the chance for it to change. So does that answer the question about why question two work? And then a question on my answer for question three here. So one question is this do while I explained why the condition, you know, while this, why we could wait after both the broadcast could happen if we were did this do while option. But a question, why isn't that okay? Because we have spurious wakeups. So spurious wakeups, you should consider unnice. Spurious wakeups are things that will happen when you don't want them to and not when you want them to. And the most common situation when they're likely to happen is when your call to the wait is really close to the call to a broadcast or another wait call. Because it has to do with the implementation details where the implementation will take some shortcut that is kind of imprecise. Okay, and then a question on question three, why does E not work? And the reason why E doesn't work is because we have the lock. So finish first and finish second will wait on the lock if we just do this. If we didn't have the lock, so if you said, okay, let's do E, but I release the lock, then we have the problem that load and store reordering like our compiler could, you know, say, oh, I know, I can just read first finish and second finished once, and that would be the problem. Does that answer that question? Follow-up questions? So, with that, I don't see any more. So let's talk. Go back to talking about monitors. So we had our example of monitors here, where we checked a condition. While it wasn't true, we waited and we had the thing that made the condition true and broadcast to say, oh, if you're waiting, you should stop waiting now. And we mentioned that there were sort of two timelines we could expect to happen here, that there's one where wait for finished happens first, in which case it's going to start waiting, and the finished thread is going to only acquire the lock after it's done waiting, and then it's going to broadcast. And then it's going to release the release the lock, and after it releases the lock, the wait for finish can actually proceed. And our alternate timeline where the finished happens first, in which case we don't even wait, but we use the lock to make sure that we're checking the finish flag, in fact, not while the finish thread is setting it. Because if we were doing it in the middle, we might get confused. You might like think that it's not finished, but try to wait after it broadcasts, and that would not work out for well for us. So something about the design here, which gets to a question I see in the direct message chat, is our condition variables always associated with a single lock. So the lock we're acquiring here, you know, we have this rule here that we'll see that we always use this lock before changing whether a thread wants to wait. So that's sort of a key part of the how we use this monitor idea, that this lock is going to protect any changes to whether we want to wait, and that's important so we know that here, in between when we check if we want to wait and when we start waiting, that doesn't change. Sort of that's the key correctness property that we're going to have when we figure out how we use condition variables. So something I mentioned last time, kind of over, is that, oh, in pthreadcon wait, it says spurious wakeups maker. So I should talk a little more about spurious wakeups. So spurious wakeups are that wait returns even though nothing happened. But as I mentioned briefly before, you know, this is not guaranteed. This is a sometimes thing. This is not a thing that necessarily will happen, but it sometimes happens. And because it sometimes happens, we'll have these while loops. But we'll see many examples where it turns out where it turns out that we kind of need that anyways, even if we didn't have spurious wakeups, and I'll talk about that with the example of producer-consumer. So if you remember, when I introduced the producer-consumer problem, the idea is that we're going to call produce from one thread and call consume from another. And the call to produce is going to add something to a queue. The call to consume is going to remove something from a queue. But the question is, what happens if there's not anything on that queue? For consume, in which case we want to wait. And in a more generalized example of this, We'll also have the same question for what if the queue is full. Here it's an unbounded queue, so we're not going to worry about that. Okay. And so here's our condition variable and lock code for that. So we have a lock, which we use before we touch this shared queue I call buffer. And I always use that because I have to worry about, you know, the internals of how that works. So, for example, if this is implemented with a linked list, you know, what if I, you know, I don't want to be trying to change the next pointer or read a next pointer while it's being changed. I want to make sure that doesn't happen. If it's like a dynamic array, I want to make sure that if the array is being reallocated, I don't read from the old one as it's being, you know, freed. So I'm going to use a lock to avoid concurrent, you know, reading while it's being modified. And I have my sort of consume code where I have my check if it's empty, and if so, the queue. And a key thing I'm relying on is that after I do this check and before I dequeue, that nothing can change about the queue. That I know that this dequeue here will always succeed because I know the queue is not empty. And this relies on the lock being held. That even if multiple threads call consume at the same time, there's no way another thread can sneak in here because it would acquire the lock first. And this is going to only be true because we always follow the convention that we touch this buffer only with the lock. If we don't do that, then, well, they could dequeue in between here and we'd have a problem. And on our produce side, I have this cons signal. So this is the first time we've seen signal instead of broadcast. So signal is going to wake up one consuming thread. And we're going to say, well, what if there's none? In that case, it's just going to do nothing. And if there's one, it's going to wake up one. And we only need to wake up one because we know that we've only enqueued one item. So there's only one consumed thread that's actually going to be do something useful. We could have made this a broadcast here. In which case, we'd wake up some extra threads, some extra calls to consume, if there were multiple in parallel, but the extras wouldn't work. The extras would start waiting again, so go back to sleep, basically. So let's go through some timelines of this. First, a question of like, so why are we using a condition variable? You know, is this just to avoid busy waiting? And well, that's the primary reason we're going to use condition variables, that we don't want to busy wait for something because that's inefficient. But if we wanted to implement this with busy waiting, then we can't do the simple thing of just crossing this out. You know, we can't do that because in that case, we would have the lock still. So we need to unacquire the lock. And that's very tricky to manage too. So usually we'll want to use this even if, you know, it's not actually going to be easier than avoiding than the busy waiting code because we need to deal with making the locking work out correctly so we don't have things like trying to access the queue while it's being reallocated. Okay, so let's look at some timelines for what happens. And I'm going to look at how many iterations this loop runs. I'm going to talk about how it can run zero iterations, one iteration, and more than one iteration. And you might think right now that, wait a minute, it can only run for more than one iteration with a spurious wake up. But there's something that can happen where that's not true. So let's look at our case of zero iteration. So the best case is that produce was called before consume was called, or at least produce got the lock before consume got the lock. And that, so in that case, produce is going to lock in queue. It's going to signal. The signal is going to do nothing because there's no one to signal, and unlock. And then our consume call is going to happen. We're going to lock. We're going to check if it's empty. The answer is no, it's not. So we're not even going to bother waiting. We're going to dequeue and unlock. Great. In that case, we don't wait at all. We have our common waiting case. So in that case, this is the if the consume call happens first. So in that case, we consume, we lock, we check if it's empty. It is, so we wait. And remember, this con wait operation both unlocks and starts waiting. It you know, adds us to the list of waiting threads and unlocks, so we don't have to worry about missing a signal. Then our produce will lock, it will enqueue, it will signal. That's going to stop us from waiting. And when it unlocks, we'll be able to run. Our consume thread, this time we'll recheck if it's empty. It's not going to be. We'll dequeue and we'll unlock. But if we look at these two timelines, you might say this should just not. If we didn't have spurious wakeups, you'd say this would just be an if statement. So let's look at a third scenario that doesn't involve spurious wakeups, but we're going to add something extra that's going to cause some problems, and that's going to be a third thread. So here I have one thread that calls produce and two threads that call consume at the same time. And our thread two is the main one we're going to look at. And so what I'm saying happens here is we call consume, we lock, it's empty, and we start waiting. Seems perfectly normal. And then I call produce, and produce locks, enqueues, signals, stops us from waiting, great, and unlocks. But while produce is running, this third thread also calls consume, and it's waiting for the lock because produce is working. And then it gets the lock, checks if the queue is empty, it dequeues, then it unlocks and returns. And this is a possible scenario. And in this case, even though there were no spurious wakeups that we really got signaled, it ends up being the case that because this third thread snuck in here, you know, after we were signaled, before we got the lock and started running, you know, we got woken up by actually being signaled, and the buffer was still empty. And some of you might have a complaint about this, which is that, you know, wait a moment. We were signaled. We should run next. That makes sense. Why isn't the threading system doing this for us? Why does it let this thread three get the lock when we were first? And that is indeed a very sensible design. And in fact, something that some condition variable implementations do. This is not what pthreads does. And it is also not what Java condition variables do or any other threading library I am aware of. But it is something that is often talked about in the literature. There have been implementations of this alternate design, which is called Hoare scheduling, named after Hoare. So these Hoare style monitors would have this signal, would ensure that we get the lock next, that there'd be an order to when threads get the lock that would be maintained and that would be guaranteed. This is not what most threading libraries do. Most do what are called MESA style monitors, where any eligible thread can get the lock next. You might say, so why would you do this? So one reason is that it simplifies the implementation, that you need less integration with the lock implementation than you would otherwise. So for Hoare style monitors, to do that handoff, you need to be integrated into the lock implementation in a very tight way. That's not necessary for MESA style monitors. Another reason might be that if you have like priority scheduling, you might prefer that the highest priority thread get the lock next and not the one that happened to be signaled first or something like that. But for whatever reason, every threading library I know of does Mason style. So that's what we're going to talk about, even though we have this kind of non-intuitive situation that causes us to need these while loops, even if spurious wakeups didn't exist. So questions about this scenario? So the question is, so there's a context switch right after the thread wakes up, but before it acquires a lock. So these scenarios are probably most pernicious when each of these threads would be on separate cores, which would be the situation we're most worried about. In which case, what would most likely happen is that thread 2 would actually be running, but have to run some code to acquire the lock. Rather than that sort of happening automatically. Does that answer questions? Other questions? Okay. So, showing you our example of using these monitors to do producer-consumer, where the consumer has to wait for more data, we can extend this and basically repeat that pattern twice to have something where the producer needs to wait if the buffer is full and the consumer needs to wait if the buffer is empty. And basically what I've done here is I've just said, oh, we're going to just do that in reverse, the waiting in reverse, and we're going to do the signaling in reverse. And this is kind of an elegant thing about how these condition variables work out, that we can just use the same pattern for every case where we'd want to wait. And that pattern is that we have a waiting loop that uses a condition variable, and we have some code when that condition would change. So in this case, when the buffer would become non-full, or in this case, when the buffer would become non-empty, that we signal someone who's waiting. And also another note about this is that here what I've done is I'm signaling here and here because I know that at most one thread can call consumer produce after I've enqueued one item or dequeued one item. But I could have been sloppier. I could have done the sloppy thing of saying, I'll just broadcast here. And that would be slow. Why would it be slow? Well, because in this case, here I'm in consume. If five threads are waiting on produce, five of them are going to run this code to check if the buffer is full, and they don't actually need to do that. Only one of them is going to find, at most, that the buffer is not full. But if I use broadcast here, at least the results would be correct. So if I wasn't sure, you know, whether more than one thread could go or not, which in more complicated code that might happen, I can broadcast, and at least I'm not going to have incorrect things happen. And this might be handy if you have scenarios where, you know, our condition is a lot more complicated than buffer.full. We're waiting for something that has like a whole bunch of components. Another thing that's notable is that here I've carefully separated my two different things I wait for into separate condition variables. And this is ideally what we want to do. But if we weren't that clever, if I just had a ready condition, well, I could just have one condition and always broadcast to it. And basically what I'd be saying is that whenever anything about the buffer changes, I'm going to wake you up and tell you, you figure out whether you care. So I could do this sloppier technique that would be slower, But, you know, it's a simple way of implementing the pattern of, I change something about the buffer, do people stop waiting? So, like, my first implementation could be, every time I change something about the buffer, I wake everyone up and they figure out whether they're ready. And this would be my sort of second implementation where I realize, wait a moment, I know the things people are checking about the buffer, I'll check them first for them and only wake them up if they care. But this gives us our sort of general pattern for how you use monitors or condition variables, that we're going to acquire a lock before we access data that is shared. And what data needs to be protected by this lock? At a minimum, everything related to the reason we'd be waiting better be protected by the lock. It has to change only when that lock is held, and we're going to check it only when that lock is held. And why is this? Well, we want to make sure that, you know, it can't be possible for it to change between when we check this while condition and when we start waiting. That would be really bad. So we can't allow condition A to change here. And the lock needs to make sure that doesn't happen. So it's important that everything that condition A deals with better be only changed when the lock is held, so we know that after we check condition A, we don't need to worry, oh, did it change before I started waiting? The answer better be no because of the lock. So we wait for something. After we're done waiting, we might change conditions. And if that's the case, other threads may have been calling cond wait, and we need to figure out, well, did their condition change, if or possibly change? You know, then we'll broadcast to them. And we'll do that for every condition that other threads could be caring about that we might have changed. And broadcast is the conservative option. If we know that the way things work, only one thread's going to care about the change, we could signal instead. And that happened in our produce-consume case because we knew that when we made the buffer, say, non-empty, we did it by putting one item on it and only one thread's going to care about that one item, so we could signal. So questions about this general pattern? So that's our monitors. So big rules. So never touch the shared data without holding the lock. And we hold the lock, notice, for the entire operation. That I don't like wait, release the lock, manipulate the data. Why not? Because condition A could change if I do that. I don't want it to change, you know, before I start waiting, and I also don't want it to change before I start doing the thing I was waiting for. Because, you know, if I was waiting for the buffer to be empty, well, if I release the lock, it might not be empty anymore. And the general rule is you look at every type of thing you wait for, and you have a condition variable, ideally for each thing. You have this loop. We have a loop. Why do we have a loop? So one reason is because of spurious wakeups. But another sort of more fundamental reason is that usually it's the case that someone could sneak in and grab the lock when we aren't expecting it, in between when we're signaled and when we, you know, start running based on that being signaled or broadcasted to. And we need to make sure that we monitor when we change a condition another thread might care about, and call broadcast or signal. Otherwise, those threads will just be left waiting indefinitely. And I mentioned there's these kind of shortcuts. So if you're, you know, not sure about whether signal will work, you can use broadcast because it's not going to change your correctness. It's just going to change your performance. If you're not sure whether you changed a condition another thread is waiting for, well, if you broadcast your signal, it's not going to break anything. It's just going to cause extra work. And if you sort of use one condition variable for multiple conditions, that's going to be suboptimal because you're going to be waking up threads to have them figure out, oh, I didn't actually care about that change, but it's still going to be functional. Questions about rules for using monitors. Let's see. So a note on monitors in POSIX. So in POSIX, we saw the mutexes before. We have condition variables, which are conT. There's nothing that explicitly links the condition variables to the mutexes. That is your job when you're to follow conventions that do that. And we can initialize monitors with conInit or with this initializer, which is the same sort of thing we saw with mutexes. There's also this attributes value that you could set to have extra features that you can look up. We're not going to use them in this class. And there's a destroy call that you're supposed to use for at least monitors that aren't global variables. Condition variables that are global variables, and mutexes that are global variables to clean up resources that might have been allocated for the mutex. Okay, so since we've seen monitors, let's do a little exercise here. And I know I've omitted some B arrows in my answers. I'm sorry. So here I want a one-use barrier. So basically I want to implement the barrier weight operation, but it's only going to work once. So we aren't implementing the resetting the barrier so I can call it again. Another seconds or so. Okay, so let's first talk about, so it looks like for blank one, majority got it right. So I'll talk about the first, sorry, for the blank one in the function, I'll talk about up here after we figure out what goes down here, because that basically determines it, is that we want to, I should write the function name. So you want to broadcast on a conditioned variable, because what this means is that we're done waiting for other threads. So we know when this is true that we don't need to wait, but we also know that other threads which may be waiting don't need to wait anymore. So I'm going to broadcast to tell them to stop waiting, and presumably that means somewhere in here that they're going to have waited on that condition variable. And our question is then, how are they waiting on it? And we have a bunch of options. So one question is, what lock are they waiting with? And we want to make sure that the lock that we're going to have here is the one that protects changes to our condition. And what's our condition? Well, our condition is something about like this. So it's going to be this lock, because if we add a new lock, well, the number reached value can change without that lock being held. And that's not going to be useful to us. So we're not going to have a second lock, because this lock is what protects our condition. And you might say, okay, so we wait in the lock. Can I just do this? And the answer is no, because of spurious wakeups. So to avoid spurious wakeups, we're going to need to have a loop around here. And that loop is going to need to check basically not this condition, which is sort of p total threads. While the total threads is is greater than the number reached, while we haven't had all the threads increment this reached counter. Okay, so this should be cond wait and cond broadcast. So questions about my solution? So questions, why is it broadcast and not signal? So in this case, if we have three threads, then thread one is going to increment the counter. So reached equals one and wait. Thread two is going to reached equals two and wait. And thread three is going to need to wake both of these two threads up. To do that, we need broadcast. Other questions, follow-ups? So question is, since cond wait is being called multiple times, is it constantly reacquiring and re-releasing the lock? So if this loop that we are calling cond wait in executes multiple times, then yes, it will acquire and release the lock several times. Other questions? So let's do a second exercise here. So here I had our produce consume with unbounded buffer. Let's extend this to handle a consume to function. My hypothetical consume to function is rather than doing item equals consume, I do item one comma item two, you know, using equals consume to. And consume two waits for there to be two items for me to get. And I'm asking, what's our general strategy for doing this? So there might be multiple things that would work. And I have asking, so first, if it just replaces consume two, that we never actually call consume directly, we always call consume two. And what if we want consume to still work? Do we have to do anything extra? And and I'm not mentioning in all the cases but we would of course call DQ twice in whatever solution we have. And even though you might not select that as one of your options, asking mainly about the changes we make to make the waiting work, which is the interesting part for condition variables. Give another 25 seconds or so. Okay, so it looks like a majority of those who answered have the canonical solution for consume to replacing consume in mind, that we don't need to signal if there's only one item on the buffer after we enqueue, and we want to wait until the buffer size is at least two. This is sort of the simplest solution. I think it's probably worth talking about why one particular idea that about 30% of those who answered selected doesn't work, which is why can't we write consume to as item one equals consume, where we had the old consume, item two equals consume, and return the pair. So why doesn't this work? So this does not work. And it's not obvious, so this does not work. But to think about why it doesn't work, let's say we have exactly two items on the queue. So let's say our queue, our buffer is A, B, and we have two threads that are calling consume to. So thread one could get item one gets A, and thread two could get item one gets B, and then thread three would get item one and would wait. So this, in this case, we'd be able to get two items, but these threads would be waiting even though there was a pair of items to get. So this would be very different than this solution, and probably not what we had in mind with this consume to function. That there were in fact two items, we called consume to, no one got them. So this solution, at least is not the same, and is probably not what someone had in mind, at least not explicitly what I mentioned on the slide, but not what you'd have in mind if you had a get a pair of items off this buffer. So the question is, consume two is split into different threads. So the idea of this example is I have two calls that with this hypothetical bad to consume two implementation, what happens if I have two calls to consume two from two different threads? Versus, let's compare what would happen to this implementation if I had those same two calls. So thread one and thread two are both calling consume two now, and our buffer is A, B. What's going to happen here is that thread one is going to do this while. It's going to say, oh, I don't need to wait. It's going to get item one gets A, item two gets B, and return. And thread two it's going to get the lock here. So it's going to wait for lock, get the lock, and then it's going to wait indefinitely. So with this bad implementation, both of the threads would end up waiting. None of them would get the pair of items. With this better implementation, at least one of the threads would get the pair of items because it's waiting for there to be two items to get rather than waiting for one item, then waiting for one item. So the question is, doesn't the lock prevent the situation in the blue at the bottom? So the lock works here because the lock is held for this period of time here. But if we can think about where the lock is held for this scenario here, well, the lock is held during the calls to consume. So we have a lock here, then we release the lock. So this can run in between, and then this unlocks, so this can run, then this unlocks, so this can run. So sort of the key insight is we need to have the lock for our entire operation if we don't want to worry about other things happening in the middle of that. And this is where we kind of got in trouble, at least, you know, arguably in trouble for that. Yeah, so this network. Okay. Other questions about this example? So the second part of that question was, let's have consume and consume two be both supported. So one way of doing this is to have two condition variables. So I have a one ready and a two ready. And my consume waits for one ready, my consume two waits for two ready, and I signal them and sure. And you might say, well, what if we have a call to consume and consume two at the same time, what's going to happen? Well, if there's, you know, say we're pushing the second item on the produce, then, well, only one of them's going to work. They're both going to wake up, but one of them's going to find out that the buffer size got reduced too much. You might say, could we avoid that? Absolutely, but we need to do some extra state tracking. And we'll look at that when we look at reader-writer locks later. But basically, if we wanted to like decide whether consume 2 or consume happened, we need to like figure out, well, is consume 2 something that we need to worry about? We need to have like some variable to track that. Questions about sort of this solution, so where we add a condition variable. For the second condition, we signal on both of them. Sometimes we're signaling when no one's waiting, and sometimes we're signaling when, well, if consume 2 happens first, for example, consume won't work. And that's, you know, a choice we've made here. If we didn't want to do that, we need to track some more information, which we will look at that kind of strategy later. So another possible solution would be we could be kind of lazy and we could keep one condition variable and just broadcast to it and say, okay, if you're calling consume or consume two, you figure it out. Is this less efficient? Absolutely. So this is probably a little more efficient. This is less efficient. And you might imagine maybe we could do something that's more efficient than this where we don't signal something that's not going to be able to work. That if like someone's calling consume and someone's calling consume two, we don't wake both of them up. We choose one to wake up. So to start thinking about that, let's look at sort of the question of, you know, guaranteeing ordering. So I kind of showed you when I showed you our example of how we could have, you know, this signaling wake us up, but the buffer not actually be ready, that we have this weirdness that the order in which you call consume is not the actual order in which you get woken up. And that's even ignoring, you know, whether con signal does the quote-unquote right thing. So one question is, well, could we, you know, fix that? Could we make it so the first call to consume always goes first? And the answer is, well, yes. And the way to think about it is that, well, how would we do this sort of, you know, if we were implementing everything the way, kind of way we saw mutexes implemented as well, we'd keep a list of waiting threads. And we can do that, but rather than, you know, needing the sort of low-level scheduler integration for that, we'll do that with our condition variable. So sort of one design is that I kind of implement my own list of waiting threads where I have a condition variable for each thread, which is this thread ready to be run? And a condition, which is, am I ready to run the thread? And rather than signaling, you know, the whole a random thread with consignal, I say, okay, I have a list of waiting threads. I'm going to dequeue one. I'm going to say, yes, you can go now. And I'm going to signal its specific condition variable. And this thread, rather than waiting for, the buffer to not be empty, it's going to wait for it to have been signaled by a producer. So you see here, by tracking information about what threads are waiting, I can, if I really want to, if I care, I can get precise control over who gets to go when. And this is a general pattern that, sometimes comes up when we use condition variables, that you might say, well, broadcast, I don't want to wake up a random thread. I don't want whoever checks the while condition to go first. If you don't want that, this is the kind of idea you can use to avoid that, that you can track who's waiting for something and, indicate not, just that there's stuff on the buffer, but that, oh, the next person to go should be this waiting thread, and make that work. Some questions about this queue of waiting threads idea? This question is, how does this guarantee the order? It guarantees the order because the order in which we call this enqueue to the waiters list is the order it will be dequeued. So the done field of the first thread to enqueue will be set first. And in case it wasn't clear, each thread sort of has their own waiter struct that they make. I guess a subtlety here that I probably should point out is, notice that this condition here, it's while not waiters.empty or the buffer is empty. And you might say, how could the buffer be empty but waiters not be empty? Well, we could have signaled someone to go but they haven't gone yet. In that case, we want to make sure this consume function, still waits for them to go. So, we're not going to be greedy and say, oh, there's something on the buffer I can dequeue. We're going to say, only if there's something on the buffer I'm dequeue and it's my turn. And possibly related to that, this is probably actually subtly incorrect. So something we need here that I should add to this slide is that, we might need, we might need to check if there's unsignaled waiters. I need to think about that. But this strategy in general is sort of how we can get precise control. We'll look at sort of a more concrete example of like how would we would use this for a more practical situation, because typically we're not getting a precise order, but we're looking for something. A little more more general. And we'll look at an example of that with reader-writer locks next time. First, in my remaining sort of 5 minutes, I'm going to introduce a different generalization of locks. So we saw monitors as a way of, you know, something where we can, you know, we can use monitors to sort of implement any waiting pattern. Sometimes we will have to do like explicit things where we like use multiple, lots of condition variables, where we keep list of condition variables to represent list of threads. We need to worry about, oh, what happens if someone's still waiting? But we can manage all that with this abstraction. And there's a completely different abstraction we're going to look at called semaphores. So semaphores, unlike monitors and condition variables, we're not going to add something in addition to locks. These are going to be kind of a direct generalization of locks that also support a wait for something operation. So rather than having locks separated from wait queues, we're going to kind of glom them together into one primitive. And we're going to find out that this semaphore idea can do everything that the condition variable and mutexes idea can do. It's just different code. And which one you'd prefer is more of a personal preference thing. So, semaphores have two operations, down and up. They also have some other names. I'm going to mostly use either down or wait or up or post. Why am I going to use those names? Because down and up, I think, are the most sensible names. Wait and post are the names that POSIX uses. And internally, the semaphore stores an integer value that's non-negative. But we're not going to directly read that value or write it. We're going to use these operations to manipulate it. The down operation is going to decrement the value by one. The up operation is going to increment it. But there's going to be some side effects. And the side effects are, well, if the value would become negative, we're not going to let that happen. Instead, we're going to wait. So if we call down and the semaphore's internal value is zero, that down operation is just going to pause until the until someone calls up to increment it to be bigger than zero. And the up operation, therefore, has the side effect of potentially waking up a thread. So we're never going to read or write it directly, and it's never going to be negative. How is it never going to be negative? Well, it's never going to be negative because we, you know, need to wait if it would become negative from our decrement operation. So you might say, how is this useful? Well, this kind of corresponds very nicely to our producer-consumer pattern. And to think about semaphores, I'll use an example of tracking copies of a library book, but we'll find out how this corresponds to like slots in a buffer and lots of other things we might use in a program. But I'm going to say copies of a library because that's a good way of thinking about why do we have a count. So here, let's say there's a library has three copies of a book. So our semaphore's value is the number of copies. If we want to take a book from the library, that's equivalent to the down operation, that it decrements the number of copies that are available. If I keep taking out copies, then I'm going to call down when there's no copies, and that's going to wait until there is a copy. So, you know, down is reserve a copy or wait for a copy to be available, then reserve it. And returning a book is the up operation. So when we return a book, we increment the number of free copies, and that immediately lets someone who's waiting for a copy get one. So this is kind of the intuition behind these semaphores. So that, you know, if we have a resource like, you know, books or slots in a buffer, the semaphore represents how much of that is available. Down is reserve one of those, up is free up one of those. Now, you might say, this seems tailor-made for the producer-consumer pattern, but we can't do other, you know, that seems too specific. How does it more general than, say, locks? So I'll finish up today by explaining how do we implement locks. And a lock is a semaphore that we just let be 1 or 0. We start it with the value 1. We say there is one lock available. To reserve the lock, you call the down operation. So you say you decrement the number of locks that are available. To free up the lock, you call the up operation. You increment the number of locks that are available. And it happens to implement exactly the sort of thing we expect for a mutex. But it's more general than that, and we'll give some examples of how it's more general next time. And I'll finish up the questions as I finish up. So the question is, internally, does a semaphore use a mutex? So that's a good question of how do we implement semaphores? And most frequently, semaphores and mutexes and condition variables will all be implemented on top of things like spin locks and integration with the scheduler. So the implementation of a semaphore will probably look kind of similar in design to that mutex implementation we saw earlier, even though it could have been implemented with a mutex and like a condition variable. So the question is, do semaphores preserve the order of threads that call down, or does it choose a random one like signal? Like with condition variables, it's going to be up to the implementation, you know, whether that's ordered or not. And often it will not be ordered. So other questions before I sign off? So next time we'll finish up semaphores. I'll probably review this example because I think I missed a corner case here. And we'll talk about some miscellaneous threading topics.